It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
I love you, Solo!
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
I want your soul.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Is that Pat Patterson?
You have legs.
Holy mackerel, did he get fat?
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No. Congratulations. Who hasn't beat Daniel Garcia?
Welcome to episode 921 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, July 20th, 2025. I am the Solo Monster for this, your first of two shows that I am doing today. Oh yes, it was wrestling galore last weekend, but there's another pay-per-view tonight that I will be talking about here in a minute. If you can believe it, WWE ran its first house show all year last night in Corpus Christi, Texas, of all places. Their first non-televised event on the calendar in 2025, and it's July. It's definitely a whole new world for this company. Rhea Ripley and Io Sky, they beat Nia Jax and Naomi. And all I saw was video of Rhea giving Nia a stink face, and then Rhea throwing Io into Nia for a stink face. While Io did that taunt that she does, she did it mid-stink face. I didn't see any clips of the actual wrestling that took place during the match. Only that. But Nia Jax appears to be a very willing participant in these situations. This is not the first time that she has had Rhea Ripley's ass shoved into her face. Lyra Valkyria beat Bayley. And I saw video from Asuka's vlog on her YouTube channel, Kana-chan TV, praising the two out of three falls match that they had on Raw Monday night. She said that these days people love to do a lot of flips and cool moves. But what she saw from Bayley and Lyra on Monday was strong style. It wasn't about big moves, she says. It was about heart. She said they showed people what wrestling is really all about. Asuka doesn't want to see no flippy shit. She just wants some strong style wrestling on her television show. Gunther and Penta, they wrestled for the first time last night as well. He pulled Penta's mask off and rolled him up for the finish. And that wasn't even the main event. Tonga Loa was in the main event. Yes! Teaming with Solo Sikoa and JC Mateo against Cody Rhodes, Randy Orton, and Jacob Fatu. So they have another show in Edinburgh, Texas tonight. But after that, I don't even know when their next house show is. And TKO plans to phase them out even more next year. I also saw that Fightful is reporting Kevin Owens finally got his neck fusion surgery on Friday. They were holding off on the surgery to allow his spinal cord some time to heal before they cut him open. I guess with the idea that maybe the surgery wouldn't need to be quite as invasive or extensive. So we'll know soon enough just how extensive it was. But given that it's July already, if he does come back to wrestle again, and I hope he does, WrestleMania next year is not happening. It's going to be a long time before we see him back in the ring again. I want to say thank you to our PayPal producers for this week. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out here on the show. Just got to go to thesolomonster.com. You'll see the link at the top of the page. And I also wanted to offer you some exclusive news updates on these fine folks. This comes courtesy of our pal Dave Meltzer in this week's Wrestling Observer newsletter. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, reportedly has a contract coming due, and he is planning to jump ship somewhere else for more money. Big B Bryant Becerra is a good friend of his, though, says that that's completely false. And in fact, Paul signed a contract extension last year. So I have no idea where Dave is getting his info from. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, reportedly has heat backstage with some of the other producers for dancing a little too much the other night and holding up the bus the next morning because he overslept. That's according to Dave. But then I've got this note here from our pal Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, who says that Harrison is one of the most well-liked people in the company and wasn't even on that loop. Dave is really slipping lately. This is terrible. Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, he got his name misspelled in the newsletter. He called him Night Walker, which carries an entirely different meaning, one that is not very flattering. I think Dave owes him an apology. Fast Blast, Tim Banks, could also mean many different things, but our friend Tim assures me that he has no issues whatsoever in that department. So blast away, good sir. This would be a good time for a Blue Chew plug, but they've never reached out to me about being a sponsor, so fuck them. Killshot Keith Hart reportedly has interest in pursuing a career in the UFC. That's according to Dave's MMA sources. And the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard. Dave only gave his match at the Collision taping 3.25 stars, but that match was easily 3.5. 4, if it happened at the Tokyo Dome. Willie, thank you. And thanks to all who supported this week. If you would like to support and get a PayPal shout on the pod, get them on in on thesolemonster.com and get your name on next week's roll call. TNA Slammiversary is tonight from the UBS Arena on Long Island, not in Long Island, and it is shaping up to be one of the biggest events in the company's 23-year history. I will be watching the show and going live on YouTube for the review immediately after. I've never done a TNA live stream review before. I've only done the reviews of their shows on the main podcast. That was years ago when I used to watch the shows every week. So this is truly a monumental occasion, or a phenomenal occasion, you might even say, because AJ Styles will be making his return to TNA tonight for the first time since 2013. TNA aired a vignette at the end of Thursday's Impact featuring old clips of him where you couldn't quite see his face, but it was unmistakable who it was. And then we saw AJ's dusty ring jacket sitting in a bin with a TNA logo on it. You could even see the P1 logo on his gear. It started really with a Twitter tease earlier in the week from TNA president Carlos Silva on Tuesday. He said, "We're moving the stage back to accommodate more fans. This event will be TNA's greatest achievement. And trust me, it's going to be phenomenal." And then TNA Vice President Ross Foreman later posted, "Slammiversary on July 20th at the UBS Arena in New York is a must-see event from TNA. Slammiversary will be the event for TNA. Slammiversary will be phenomenal." Now, it won't be a match, I can't imagine. Probably a promo or an angle maybe to lead to a match. There was an open challenge from Steve Maclin that was announced on Thursday's show, but they have since announced Maclin for a 6-man tag on the pre-show. So I'm not sure what changed there. Per the latest update from WrestleTix, they are up to 6,400 tickets distributed for a setup of 7,000 at the UBS Arena, which fits closer to 20,000. So the building is hardly going to be full. But with strong walk-up, they should easily get that number over 7,000 by showtime tonight. The biggest crowd in TNA history was their lockdown show in 2013 from the Alamo Dome. Yes, they did a show at the Alamo Dome. Do you know how many people the Alamo Dome fits? A lot. Like 70,000. And they roped off a very small section of it to do a pay-per-view there. But after all these years, it is still the biggest crowd they've ever done. A little over 7,000 fans. Which, honestly, if you think about it, is kind of sad because this company's been around almost 25 years. And think of the biggest names in the business. At one time, many of them were in TNA, on the TNA roster. Right? You had Hogan and Flair and Sting. And I mean, obviously, they had a lot of homegrown talent like Joe and AJ and Abyss and people like that as well. But Booker T and Kevin Nash and like big names that people would recognize. And just to think that in almost 25 years that they, at least in North America, have never been able to hit 10K for an audience is kind of shocking, actually. But it's very likely they're going to break that record. They announced that more tickets have been added due to high demand. I know they sold out all of their floor seats. This is the benefit of partnering with WWE. You know, for anyone still wondering what TNA is getting out of it, you're seeing what they're getting out of it. Now, the pre-show starts at 7 o'clock Eastern time with the main card to follow at 8 p.m. Here is a rundown of the card and my predictions, which have not changed too much, just a little bit from last week. 2 pre-show matches. Steve Maclin, Jake Something, and Mance Warner are going to be taking on Real One, Zilla Fatu, and Josh Bishop. Now, they originally announced an open challenge for Macklin's TNA International Championship to anyone from any company internationally, he said. I assume this is no longer happening. Now, there have been vignettes airing for the past couple of weeks with Real One. If you don't know who Real One is, that's the former Enzo Amore. That's the name he goes by now. And they actually, when they would air, they preceded Macklin's segments over the last 2 weeks. So it looked like there was some kind of connection there. The video this week was shot NWO style and brought to you by the Fourth Rope promotion, which is run by Westside Gunn. Enzo is their flyweight champion. And in it, he said that he was coming to Slammiversary, but he was not going to come alone. He was also bringing along Zilla Fatu, who was the promotion's heavyweight champion. And he was bringing a bishop with him. And we know now that bishop is Josh Bishop, who also wrestles for Fourth Rope. Yeah, looking at him, he reminds me a lot of Dr. D. I'm getting a lot of David Schultz vibes from looking at this guy. I'm going with Macklin, Jake Something, and Mance Warner for the win. I think the TNA talents take it. We have the TNA Knockouts tag team titles on the line. The Elegance brand take on the Inspiration, which is the former Iconics, who just returned to TNA last month after a three-year absence. I believe they've held these titles before. I believe they will hold them again. I predict a title change. On the main card, we have Dark State from NXT taking on The System and Matt Cardona. Cardona will be teaming with Eddie Edwards, Brian Myers, and JDC, or Dirty Dango, against all four members of Dark State. This stems from an angle on Impact Thursday night where Dark State attacked Cardona, but The System came out to his rescue. Cardona and Myers obviously have history together. They won two tag team titles in WWE, and this just feels like a way to get two Long Island boys on the card at UBS. I'm going with Dark State, though, for the win. I think they've been fairly protected so far in their run on NXT, and I don't see them getting beat here. We have Indy Hartwell one-on-one against Tessa Blanchard. I'm going with Tessa for the win. Mustafa Ali takes on Cedric Alexander. I've gone back and forth on this one. I'm going to go with Ali. I think they drag this out a little bit longer. I'm going with Ali for the win. There's a four-way tag team ladder match for the TNA World Tag Team Championship. Nick and Ryan Nemeth are the defending champions. They put those titles on the line against the Hardys, the Rascals, and First Class, which is AJ Francis and Casey Navarro. On Thursday's Impact, the Hardys cut a promo and said that if they fail to win back the tag team titles here, maybe it's time for the Hardy Party to end. Now, I was originally going to go with the Nemeths to retain, but I have changed my mind. I don't think the Hardys would be saying that unless they were winning the belts back. I think the Hardys are going to win those tag team titles. I can't see it being the Rascals because Trey Miguel is having hernia surgery after the show. He just wants to get through this match first, so it doesn't seem very likely that they're going to win the titles. By the way, he's having a real rough go of it lately. He posted on Twitter that his uncle, Andy, fell off a 12-foot ladder and landed on his head. And his uncle is like a second father to him. Now he's in a medically induced coma with a 50-50 chance of making it. He said, "My family just can't take this right now. I've seen him every day for the first 27 years of my life. Every time I dust myself off, this happens again. I can't take it anymore." So send him some love if you can spare a minute, because he's going through a tough time right now. TNA X Division Championship on the line. Moose defends against Leon Slater. If Slater wins, he would become the youngest X Division champion of all time. Moose has had that title since October. I say he finally loses it here. Then we have winner take all. Title for title, the TNA Knockouts champion Masha Slamovic defends against the NXT Women's Champion JC Jane. Both titles will be on the line, which means, I mean, barring some sort of disqualification or no contest, which I suppose is possible, one of these women is going to walk out with two titles. I don't see that being JC Jane. I think if anybody does win both belts here and there's no, you know, bullshit finish, I think Masha Slamovic is leaving with both belts. And the TNA World Heavyweight Championship on the line in a triple threat main event. It will be Trick Williams of NXT defending the TNA World title against the former champion Joe Hendry and the future champion Mike Santana. Because whether it happens tonight, whether it happens at Bound for Glory, Mike Santana will be the TNA World Heavyweight Champion. I have no doubt about that. It should be tonight. And I think it would be very appropriate for it to be tonight in front of friends and family, his daughter in New York City. What a great moment that would be. So I'm going with Santana. I felt the same way about Joe Hendry at Slammiversary a year ago. And they waited and they waited. And they I think they beat him again at Bound for Glory. And it wasn't until, what, January, I think, that he won the belt. So they could always drag this out. But I feel like tonight should be Santana's night. And I think it will be. So again, when the show is over, probably around 11 or so, I will be live on YouTube. I hope you join me there. Even if you don't watch the show, come hang out for the review. Following his match with LA Knight at Saturday night's main event, ending prematurely due to an apparent injury, quote unquote, Seth Rollins was spotted backstage at Evolution the next night on crutches, had a giant brace on his knee. He was there to watch his wife's match. He has been spotted elsewhere on crutches with that same brace on his leg, including the Rich Eisen show on Wednesday, which he was guest hosting. Monday night on Raw, he was not there. And Paul Heyman said that he had no information to share about Rollins other than he has until next June to cash in his Money in the Bank contract. On the Eisen show, Rollins did address his health at the very top of the show. This is what he had to say. You can see myself on the monitor right there. I look great. I'm not going to lie, but underneath this monitor, I do have a leg brace. On over there in the corner are my crutches. This past Saturday, I was in a match on Saturday night's main event, a special on NBC on Peacock. I was in a match with LA Knight and I hurt my knee. I was doing a move that I do all the time. It's a moonsault, a backflip. In this particular instance, I was landing not on my belly, but I was landing on my feet when I landed. I felt my knee pop and buckle. And we got to get out of the match. We move forward. Monday, I was in Birmingham, Alabama, where our specialists are. We tried to take a look at the knee through some imaging. It was a little too swollen, so we're going to take another look, hopefully in a week or two here in LA, to try to get some sort of firm diagnosis, and then we can go from there. I am not a doctor. I only know my body and what I feel. What I feel is that this is going to put me out for an extended period of time. We were talking off air earlier. Huge, huge bummer. And it is a bummer. But look, it is what it is. Our business moves on. This isn't the first time I've been injured. It won't be the last. And I have always just got WrestleMania in the back of my mind. I'm like, can I make it back for WrestleMania season? And so that's where my brain goes. I feel good about that. But beyond a firm timeline, I just won't know until we get a better answer on the MRI. So then TJ Jefferson, who's a regular contributor on the Eisen show, asked how Rollins is doing mentally, given that he was in the middle of a main event program. He said, there's no good time to get injured. There's no, oh, this is the best time of year for this to happen, or you're not being used very much, so you take a break. But this is not my first rodeo. I had a very serious knee injury, same knee actually, back in 2015. I was in a much different state of mind at that point in my career, where I was still feeling like I needed to work to get to the top. Now I'm sort of at the top. And then the co-hosts were laughing like, oh, sort of. He says, I've had multiple injuries over the years, so I know what it feels like to take a step back. But I also have confidence in our roster, in our team, that they're going to be able to move things forward in a way that is entertaining. I don't want to say they don't need me, but we're good. We're in a good place right now. And when I come back, I'll be better than ever. Mentally, I'm just in a much different place than 10 years ago. I'm more comfortable with it. I'm trying to find the silver linings here. Things like my daughter's 4 and a half now. I'm going to be able to spend a lot of time with her that I might not have been able to otherwise because the schedule is going to get crazy. We have a bunch of international stuff coming up, so I would have been gone for all of that. So I think mentally I'm in a good place. And then he just goes on a little bit more. He did seem to be in remarkably good spirits considering he thinks he hurt his knee even worse than he did last time. And this is someone who was in the midst of the biggest push that he's had in years. And after I saw what happened on Saturday night's main event, I did notice the referee, Jessica Carr. She never threw up the dreaded X sign, which is what they do when somebody gets legitimately hurt. But I didn't think too much of it, and I thought he really was hurt, right? We just didn't know how serious the injury was. But the way that they did the sudden finish with Knight beating him with the BFT and then cutting away from him post-match, it felt like this was a real injury. Then John Pollock of Post Wrestling reported that he was informed 48 hours before Saturday night's main event by a source who would be in the know to keep his eyes peeled for an injury angle involving Seth Rollins. one that would put him on crutches heading into SummerSlam. And Pollock is not somebody that's just going to pull that out of thin air. If he says that this is what he was told by somebody 2 days before, that this is what we're doing, then this is what he was told that they're doing. And what a coincidence that Seth Rollins got hurt in his match on Saturday night's main event. He said, I was told this 2 days before the match happened. The fact is, I was told this in advance, so this person is not psychic. They're not Nostradamus. There are only two options here, either that this was a work or that they were planning a work and he really did get hurt, and I don't think that's the case. Brian Alvarez has since said the reason these stories are conflicting is because he is hurt, but what happened on Saturday was a storyline, meaning he's hurt, but he did not get hurt on that spot. That spot was a cover for an injury that he has, which he will have to get worked on. The idea suggested was that he will be out of action for a little while, but they're going to say something like 9 months, but he will be back much sooner than that. So basically, the John Cena torn pec deal from 2007, when he tore his pec in that Raw match against Mr. Kennedy and then had to vacate the WWE title, right? He had that title for over a year by that point. So that was a shitty way for a 13-month title reign to come to an end. But it was a torn pec. So you figured, man, this guy's going to be gone for at least 5 or 6 months. And instead, he was back in 3. That's when he entered the Royal Rumble as a surprise in number 30, and everybody was shocked. Cena doesn't have mutant healing powers so much as he probably wasn't as injured as they suggest that he was. Maybe the tear wasn't as bad. So when he came back early, it just caught everybody by surprise. What Alvarez is suggesting is that this is a similar situation where people think he may be out for 6 to 9 months, but maybe he comes back in, who knows, 2 or 3. In which case, there is no need to get the Money in the Bank briefcase off of him. I was floating an idea to do just that, only if he really was hurt that badly and they thought he might actually miss a year or more. There was a way to do it where he tries to hand the briefcase off to Bron Breakker. Adam Pearce, though, doesn't allow it. He makes a new Money in the Bank match for SummerSlam, and then as a concession, he allows Breakker and Bronson Reed to enter without having to qualify. So now Seth's crew is represented, and you get a big attraction for SummerSlam. But it doesn't sound like that's going to be necessary. So I'm not saying the entire thing is a work. I could see him maybe having a minor injury, and this was a cover angle for that. But do I think what we saw on Saturday night's main event was planned the way it was? I do. I no longer think that everything was on the up and up there. You know, after the injury spot, Michael Cole made mention, I think I said this in my review of Saturday night's main event, but Michael Cole said that Seth had tweaked that same knee or he had hurt that same knee, something to that effect, during his match with Penta the previous Monday, and I had no idea what he was talking about because I don't remember. I watched that match, I reviewed it, and I don't remember them mentioning anything about Seth hurting his knee. It just felt like something they made up to add to the story here. So how deep the work goes, I don't know. It may well, again, be a cover for a real injury that isn't too serious. You know, you guys know I'm not the conspiracy theory type generally, but if Pollock is saying he was told 48 hours before the show that there was going to be an injury angle, and I think Dave said the same thing, but if Pollock is saying that, then something is definitely cooking here. Mike Johnson of PW Insider has insisted from day one that it is not a work, and it is a very legitimate injury. I would love for it to be a work, because just the timing of this could not be any worse. And if they can pull this off, and it is a ruse, and he shows up and cashes in to win the title at SummerSlam, let's say, kudos to them. I only hope they weren't working people like LA Knight and others who were close to this, because that would be really shitty to not clue them in on what was happening and keep them in the dark thinking that this guy got hurt during your match. I think that sucks. But otherwise, if they could pull off something like this and pull off a shocking moment, then hey, more power to him. Remember, Rollins said on television only a few weeks ago when he was in the ring with Gunther, talked about making sure that CM Punk never wins a world championship. So long as Rollins has breath in his lungs, he has made it his life's mission to make sure that CM Punk never holds a world championship. So on Monday night, they had a gauntlet match, 5-man gauntlet match. CM Punk entered last, And he beat Bron Breakker to win the gauntlet, which was to decide a number one contender for Gunther at SummerSlam. And so look at who's the number one contender all of a sudden for the World Heavyweight Championship. CM Punk is going to the main event probably of night one at MetLife Stadium, where he lost to The Undertaker many years ago, and is challenging for the World Heavyweight Championship. Rollins cashing in to screw Punk out of winning the world title would make all the sense in the world. And I think enough people are talking about this now, though, that I do wonder if they would hold off and not do the cash in at SummerSlam, since everybody would be expecting it, and do it in Paris or some other show where people wouldn't be expecting it. So I'm fully expecting a Money in the Bank cash in very soon, as in the next month or two. I'm not 100% sure it'll be at SummerSlam, but it would make all the sense in the world if he's physically able to do so at SummerSlam, and that's how you end night one. You want to end night one in a big way. The only way to do it would really be to have Seth live up to his promise. I told you, I will not allow you to become World Heavyweight Champion. So it's not even a case of him letting Punk win and then cashing in, and Punk is champion for 5 minutes. Like, if they do it, he would have to cash in during the match and completely prevent Punk from even winning the championship in the first place. Now, after that gauntlet match on Monday, which was the first time that I can remember a gauntlet being no disqualification, we weren't told why, but it was clearly done just to allow Bronson Reed to interfere. Since Bron Breakker started the gauntlet, he went all the way to the end. Jey Uso came back out after being eliminated earlier in the gauntlet to provide the assist to Punk. Punk ended up winning, but then he and Jey got beat down after it was over. And before Bronson Reed could pancake the two of them all stacked up, Roman Reigns made his return, his first appearance since WrestleMania. And he laid out Bron Breakker, he laid out Bronson Reed, and then he helped his cousin back up to his feet. So the parting scene on Monday night seemed to indicate a tag team match may be coming for SummerSlam. I would not etch that into a stone tablet yet. Roman has been announced for Raw each of the next 2 weeks. I wouldn't mind them doing the tag match on Raw next week to give Raw a rare Roman Reigns match, and let the tag match set up two singles matches for SummerSlam. Because it is two nights, after all. They could do Jey Uso against Bronson Reed, and they could do Roman Reigns against Bron Breakker. Reigns against Breakker in a singles match is more intriguing to me than a tag team match. John Cena, speaking of big names that have not been around lately but made their return this week, Roman Reigns was back on Raw, John Cena was back on SmackDown Friday night, his lone July date on the road to SummerSlam for a contract signing with Cody Rhodes. He tried to back out of the match, citing mental and emotional exhaustion. He has been filming a movie, he said, for Netflix in New York City, and they all agree that it would be best if he didn't compete at SummerSlam. So basically playing up the Hollywood diva card to get him more heel heat. He did say, though, remember, he was going to retire with the title at the end of the year and ruin wrestling. So he's trying to duck Cody as long as he can and run out the clock, it looks like. Cody was having none of this. He went on the attack. He put Cena through a table with this giant flying splash off the top rope in his suit with the contract binder in his hand. Like a CEO diving through the boardroom table, he looked like. Or that CEO who got caught at the Coldplay concert. Actually, that CEO would be the one on the table. The one diving through the air in a suit with the contract binder in his hand would be his wife's divorce attorney, with the divorce documents inside that binder. I love that one joke I saw, by the way. Coldplay hasn't made a single in years, but in one night they made two. Actually, they made four, if you count their spouses. What a missed opportunity, though, by the way, for WWE to do something out of the box like that with Dominic and Roxanne Perez. Like, he probably wouldn't be spotted at a Coldplay concert, but like, work it out where they put him and Roxanne on the kiss cam when they're getting all cozy, and then you see that look of fear in their eyes as they scramble. Probably would have been better to do something like that when Liv Morgan was closer to coming back, but that would have been amazing. It's not what you think. The only problem with the segment here from SmackDown is that Cody forced an unconscious man to sign this contract, which would never hold up in a court of law. So I hope Cena gets his vast team of lawyers to challenge this. Take him to Little People's Court under the ring, maybe. Cody told him to look at the fine print. Their match at SummerSlam will now be a street fight. Which is good that they added a stipulation to this, because I saw their first match without a stip, and it was one of the worst WrestleMania matches I've ever seen. Now, Cena's had a couple of good ones since then, one with Randy Orton, one with CM Punk. So I'm hopeful that we can get that Cena this time. But with the street fight stipulation also comes a lot of fan theories about what they think is going to happen at SummerSlam, or who's going to get involved. And one theory spreading around social media, and people have tagged me in this and shared it with me, and they wanted my thoughts on it. It's been going around like a virus. One theory has Cena and Cody doing a double turn, because these people simply will not rest until they have turned Cody Rhodes to the dark side. Now they're pointing out that Cody was wearing glasses for a brief moment on SmackDown on Friday night. They showed him in the back. He was walking to the ring for the contract signing. He was wearing glasses. But wait, those look like the same glasses that The Rock wore on the Netflix premiere. Oh my God, they've got the same glasses. Cody Rhodes told The Rock to go fuck himself in March, unless he bought him a pair of Oliver Peoples. Then he would happily sell his soul to him. And then they pointed out the watch that Cody was wearing. It looked like the same watch that Rock had on when he came back. So what I'm getting out of this is that they both shop at the same places. Evidently, to a lot of fans, though, this is a sign that Cody Rhodes will turn heel and sell his soul to the final boss at SummerSlam. They're going to recreate the moment from Elimination Chamber right down to the throat slash, but this time Cody will sell his soul to The Rock. And you know what that'll be? Oh, you know what that'll be. You know the word. Wait for it. Wait for it. Absolute cinema. Yes, bad cinema. The kind of cinema that gets a Rotten Tomatoes score of 90%. There is so much wrong with this, I don't even know where to begin, but how about this? I am not against turning Cody Rhodes heel. At some point, he will turn heel. It is inevitable. I don't think it's going to be at SummerSlam. I don't think it should be at SummerSlam. Outside of some light booing here and there, it's not like the fans are in full rebellion against this guy because they're so sick of him. He's still their top babyface. He's still the guy. And until they have that other guy that can step in and be the top babyface and fill that role when Cody goes heel, I think it would be foolish to turn him right now. The idea of a Cody Rhodes-Randy Orton program with Cody as the heel and Randy as the face is intriguing to me, but what happens when that feud runs its course? You know, Randy Orton is not a long-term solution in that spot. So let me just say that I don't hate the idea of Cody Rhodes turning heel. I hate this idea, this notion that some fans have that The Rock has to be involved when it happens. This can happen without The Rock. Why does Cody Rhodes need to sell his soul to The Rock after rejecting him at Elimination Chamber and telling him to go fuck himself? And if he wins the title back at SummerSlam without Rock's help, which is how this scenario was mapped out in this one meme or fan theory that was going around, why would Cody feel compelled to then sell his soul to The Rock? Like, it doesn't even make any sense. Cody's taking time off after SummerSlam to go film for Street Fighter. He's in the new Naked Gun movie. What does he need Rock for? Did he secretly sell his soul months ago and didn't tell anybody, and that's why he's landing all these Hollywood roles all of a sudden? It goes against everything the Cody Rhodes character stands for. It doesn't make a lick of sense. John Cena, at least, okay, he's the aging gunslinger in his final year. He came into this year on a horrible losing streak, desperate to win number 17. It was now or never. You can make sense out of that. There was a story there to tell, even though they never really told it. They never said anything about him being desperate to win number 17. They never said anything about him being desperate to turn his fortunes around. They went with, you used to boo me years ago and you hurt my feelings, so now I'm going to ruin wrestling. That was the story. And they very clearly did so without putting any real thought into where they were going to go with it. John Cena is going to turn back. He's going to get his redemption arc. That was always the plan. There is no way that he does not turn back before he retires. And it may well even happen at SummerSlam. And you know what? They might even do a double turn. I can't rule it out. I am not saying that it is impossible to conceive of a double turn at SummerSlam. It could happen. But this idea that The Rock has to be involved is fucking nauseating. Like, do these people have short-term memory loss? Do they not remember what happened earlier this year? I don't want him anywhere near this after the shit they pulled. He's not going to be around. What's he going to do? He's going to show his face to get the pop and then make himself part of the moment just to disappear again. Are we going to go through this every year now until we get the eventual Cody and Rock match that probably is never going to happen? But hey, I mean, good on Rock. He got to pin Cody Rhodes in the Night One main event last year. I don't know that Cody will ever get that win back. Rock does not need to be involved in any of this. Keep him far away from that match. Because the last time Rock was involved, or not involved, it ended with him going on Pat McAfee's show to do damage control. Not everything has to revolve around The Rock. And if you feel like it does, then there are some very serious problems with the product that need to be addressed. WWE also got some mainstream pub this week when Jelly Roll, who is tagging with Randy Orton against Drew McIntyre and Logan Paul at SummerSlam, guest hosted Jimmy Kimmel Live on Wednesday night. Randy was a guest on the show. About 5 minutes into the interview, McIntyre crashed the show. He called Jelly Roll trailer trash and congratulated him on losing 200 pounds so he could see his pecker again. In so many words, he said this. Orton shoved Drew. Drew shoved back. The two of them brawled out of the studio. Jelly was left standing there all alone, so he was about to throw it to a commercial when Logan Paul showed up. And he slapped him in the face as a receipt for Jelly Roll punching him in the face on Saturday night's main event. Jelly Roll then chokeslammed him through the desk, which collapsed like it was made out of cardboard, and Logan sold it like he was dead. And then Jelly Roll plugged their match at SummerSlam. It came off very hokey, but the audience cheered, and it was a great way for them to plug the pay-per-view, in case you're wondering, you know, why do they have Jelly Roll wrestling in a match at SummerSlam? This sort of thing is the reason why. And you know why I can't really be mad at it? It's an undercard match on a show with two nights to fill. The dude is a fan. He's committed to promoting this thing. He's putting the work in, too. At the Performance Center, he's been training with Jacob Fatu and The Undertaker, and Kevin Owens, I think, was giving him pointers. Fucking Jelly Roll is making more appearances for them heading into SummerSlam than John Cena. Compare this to Travis Scott. And in The Observer this week, Meltzer said one person in WWE told him he doesn't like to commit to anything. He goes half in and he tries other projects at the same time. Well, I mean, so does Cena right now. But anyway, since he's a personal client of Ari Emanuel, everyone tried to accommodate Travis until it just became too much to deal with. I would say in hindsight, it was a terrible idea to send him out there during the WrestleMania main event. But I knew it was a terrible idea the minute I heard Fiend. And he took 84 years to walk to the ring. Good riddance. I better not see him pop up in that street fight at SummerSlam. By the way, Pat McAfee confirmed on his show this week that he has stepped away from WWE for the time being, citing burnout. So Corey Graves doing Raw with Michael Cole is a permanent thing now. Nobody is happier about this, I'm sure, than Corey Graves. McAfee is going to be on his way out soon anyway, even if he didn't choose to leave when he did, because football season is right around the corner. So it's possible he comes back next year, but for the foreseeable future, it is Cole and Graves on the call. Now, here's the current lineup for SummerSlam at MetLife Stadium. John Cena defends the WWE Championship against Cody Rhodes in what will now be a street fight. Before he goes off to film Street Fighter, Cody will have himself a street fight. Gunther defends the World Heavyweight Championship against CM Punk. Roman Reigns and Jey Uso, I mean, this is yet to be made official. Again, could be two singles matches, but probably going to be a tag match against Bron Breakker and Bronson Reed. Rhea Ripley, Io Sky, and Naomi. Triple threat match for the Women's World Championship. I'm very much looking forward to that one. Tiffany Stratton against Jade Cargill for the WWE Women's Championship. That one, not so much. Randy Orton and Jelly Roll against Drew McIntyre and Logan Paul. Solo Sikoa against Jacob Fatu inside a steel cage for the United States Championship. I believe this is the first steel cage match at SummerSlam since 2001, when Undertaker and Kane beat DDP and Canyon. Like, could that even be right? Like, we're not counting Hell in a Cell, we're not counting Elimination Chamber, nothing like that. There hasn't been a steel cage match at SummerSlam in 24 years. Like, that seems almost impossible to me. And the funny part about that is, my favorite all-time SummerSlam match was a steel cage match from 1994 between Bret and Owen. But to think that it's been almost 25 years, unless I'm missing one, since we've had a regular cage match on this show, is kind of crazy. Becky Lynch will defend the Intercontinental Championship against Lyra Valkyria. And apparently on Raw tomorrow night, Becky will have a proposition of some kind for Lyra. Raquel Rodriguez and Roxanne Perez will defend the women's tag team titles against Charlotte Flair and Alexa Bliss. After Charlotte just walked into Adam Pearce's office, not even on camera. This is just her telling Alexa, here's how I got us a title badge. I just went to the GM and I asked for it and he gave it to me. And that's how this match came about, because she's Charlotte Flair, damn it. She doesn't have to qualify for shit. But it is the right match to be doing. So those are the likely or confirmed matches that we know of so far. Now, it is two nights this year, so we're probably looking at another four or five matches. AJ Styles against Dominic Mysterio for the Intercontinental title has been teased. Adam Pearce says Dom is going to be reevaluated by WWE Medical this week, and if he's cleared, he will make that match official for SummerSlam. Maybe you throw in at least one tag team title match. You know, after I said this on Friday, after being left off the WrestleMania card, those SmackDown teams deserve a spot on one of those two nights. Sami Zayn against Karrion Kross is happening on Raw tomorrow night. Sheamus against Rusev is happening on Raw tomorrow night. So those probably aren't, I mean, they could run them back again, but those probably aren't happening at SummerSlam again. But maybe Damian Priest against Aleister Black. They've been pushing that direction on SmackDown. Julia, she won the United States Championship and has not been seen since. Not in the ring, I guess, outside of that battle royal at Evolution. She just did an interview saying that she won't be able to forgive herself if she does nothing for those 2 days. She wants to have a title match on that show. I don't even think she makes it onto the card, which is really shitty, because when people start talking, and they already are, like, it's already happening, but when people start talking about how cold her run has been, what a cold run, what a cold title run she's had, it's because of stuff like this. There is no reason, 2 hours, 3 hours, there's no reason a champion should not be featured with some regularity on these shows. They have no problem featuring the women's Intercontinental Champion on Mondays because it's Becky Lynch. So of course she's going to be featured. They need to keep that same energy when Lyra beats her to win the belt back. And they need to keep that same energy for Julia, who frankly needs it more than Lyra does, because Lyra's been able to establish herself through this program with Becky. Julia hasn't even gotten a shot yet, but it's not looking good. Today's episode is sponsored by Factor Form. A couple of years back, I tried a green supplement for the first time. I didn't even really know what they were, but I knew it would be good for my health, so I figured, well, let's give this a shot. And I swear, I wanted to gag. I said never again, but I'm glad I reconsidered, because the first time I gave Factor Form's Daily Greens a chance, it was night and day. It's one thing to tolerate something that you think is good for you, even if it tastes terrible, but it's better to find something you actually enjoy that doesn't taste like grass. That's what I was able to find with Daily Greens by Factor Form. Factor Form has changed the game in that respect. As the sister brand to Factor Meals, which you've heard me talk about here on this podcast, Factor Form was designed to work hand in hand with your meals, making better nutrition a breeze. Daily Greens is a greens powder by Factor Form that in one scoop delivers 100% of your daily nutrients, filling in nutrient gaps, supporting whole body health, and helping you feel your very best. With a refreshing, citrusy, smooth taste that's actually enjoyable to drink. You simply mix a single serve pack with water and you're good to go. It's nice to have a greens drink that doesn't taste like I'm licking a chalkboard. Daily Greens by Factor Form is made from real vegetables, packed with a whole serving of kale and spinach without tasting like it. In fact, in a blind taste test, Daily Greens ranked number one in taste, texture, and aroma, beating out the biggest names in the industry. Factor Form's Daily Greens is packed with prebiotics, probiotics, and adaptogens to support gut health and reduce bloating. There's no added sugar and no artificial fillers. Just whole food ingredients that work. So much so that 88% of users experienced improved digestion and gut health. I've been trying it out myself recently, and it's infinitely better than some of the others that I've tried before. Within days, you'll feel more energetic, less bloated, and your mind will be sharper. It's a daily habit that doesn't feel like a chore. It feels like a necessity. Start your day right with Daily Greens by Factor Form at factor75.com/solomonster to get 40% off plus free shipping on your first order. That's factor75.com/solomonster for 40% off plus free shipping. factor75.com/solomonster. I have been waiting all week to talk about this. Fresh off his retirement match with Gunther on Saturday night's main event, Bill Goldberg appeared on Ariel Helwani's show this week, and it was not what I was expecting it to be. I don't think Ariel was expecting it either. Goldberg is not happy. I mean, when is Goldberg happy? But he was not happy. Actually, no, scratch that. He's pissed off about how aspects of his retirement were handled. And for all the times in the interview that he made sure to say, I'm not complaining, but he sure did a lot of complaining. And he also said that he would have a lot more to say about things in 2 weeks, which at this point is about a week away. And when Ariel asked if that meant that he signed a non-disclosure agreement that expires in 2 weeks, he said, yeah, let's just say that. So I don't know if he actually signed an NDA. That would be weird to me. It may just be a case of whatever deal he signed with them is up in 2 weeks. And at that point, he said that he'll be able to spill the beans on things that he wants to talk about. You know, I've clowned on Goldberg a lot in recent years. I thought there were multiple times where he was brought back to the detriment of the product and the current roster. Some of his performances were not good. He almost killed The Undertaker a few years ago. But I've always given him his flowers for the run that he had during the Monday Night War. And I have acknowledged his place in that era. This guy came out of nowhere. Absolutely out of nowhere. Nobody knew who he even was. And he got white hot. And he was a very big part of WCW's success in the late 90s. He was that shining star that was inevitably going to burn out because he was very one-dimensional. And also, he was working for a company that was being run by fucking morons. And that's what happened. It wasn't entirely of his own making. The booking had a lot to do with it. But as hot as he got in 98, by 99, as the year went on, Goldberg didn't really feel like Goldberg anymore. But even after that match last weekend, I gave the man props for his performance. I was expecting that match to be a lot worse than it was. And it went 14 minutes. In his retirement match, Goldberg went out there and had his longest singles match in 22 years. At 58 years old, with all the injuries that he himself has said that he's been dealing with, a bad knee, a bad shoulder. 14 minutes. If you would have told me before the show, hey, Goldberg's going to wrestle a 14-minute match, I would have said whoever formatted the show should never be allowed to format the show ever again. That sounds like a terrible idea. That would have sounded like a terrible idea 25 years ago. But he hung in there just fine, and credit to him for playing his part, and credit to Gunther. Yeah, there's a reason they call him the Ring General. He made Goldberg look like a destroyer. I thought his retirement actually went as well as you possibly could have hoped for, outside of his retirement speech getting cut off there at the end, which is one of the things that he clearly is very pissed off about. And that I can understand. It was also something out of WWE's control because on NBC, they had a hard stop at 10 p.m. I don't know why they couldn't have kept the feed going on Peacock, but they did quickly upload the full speech to their YouTube channel. It has since racked up well over a million views, which is comparable to what it would have gotten on NBC. I came out of that show, though, you know, as a fan watching this, feeling pretty good for Goldberg with the way things ended. He got what he wanted. He got his retirement match that he has been bitching and moaning about for the past few years. I'm owed a retirement match. You're not owed jack shit. But WWE gave him one anyway, maybe more so to get him to shut up about it, whatever their motives were. I can't say for sure. I'm sure it was also to stick it to AEW on All In Weekend to try to steal headlines away from them. Hey, you know, we'll promote Bill Goldberg's retirement match that weekend. I'm sure WWE had their reasons for doing it. A lot of guys don't get to have a retirement match or a speech or the send-off that this guy had. Most guys don't. But he got it. He didn't like how his match with Roman Reigns went down 3 years ago, and he didn't want that to be the last time people saw him in the ring. So he got the match. And everything seemed nice. And then he had to go and throw shade on the entire thing and turn it into a big story this week. He's still complaining. He got the match he wanted, and yet he still complains. He would fit in very well in the IWC. He told Ariel, let's just say I'm pissed off at the way I went out, because I put so much into it. I don't feel as though the effort was reciprocated to put a stamp on what I've accomplished. Again, I'm not going to say that I'm not ecstatic with the opportunity that I got. I think it could have been done a little bit differently, that's all. I'm happy with my performance. I'm happy with the setting. But it could it have been better? Absolutely. It can always be better. And you know what? I feel like if things would have been left at that quote, like, that's reasonable. Like, he sounds in that quote like, look, I really appreciate the opportunity and I'm overall happy with how things went, but there were certain things that I wasn't happy about. Fair point. But they went on and he was asked if he would have preferred the match to have taken place on a PLE instead of live TV. And Goldberg said, absolutely. They cut me off after freaking 20 seconds with the microphone in my hand, for God's sake. Now, I should say he did put over Gunther as a great opponent and an amazing performer. He even said he was having fun in the ring, and that's something he doesn't say very often. You could tell there was a moment where Gunther chopped him, and Goldberg just looked down at his chest and he looked up and smiled. Like, totally no-sold it, but he looked like he was genuinely enjoying himself in there. And Gunther totally led that match. I mean, you could literally see him mouthing spots and calling spots to Goldberg throughout the entire thing. But Goldberg also said the match not being announced until 3 weeks out, even though it had been decided on in January, made it difficult for him to contact people to be part of his walkout entourage. There were certain ex-teammates of his and his coach from the Atlanta Falcons who ended up being overseas, I think on a vacation. He wasn't able to make it. You know, it's weird because he admits that he knew the when and where of his retirement match, right down to it being on Saturday night's main event and it being in Atlanta. He knew this as far back as November. But then in the next breath, he says, well, we only had 3 weeks to build it, so I wasn't able to get everybody out who I wanted to be there. I don't know if he's implying that he was sworn to secrecy and he was not allowed to tell anybody about the match or what, because if not, then he could have just told them months ago, hey, look, I'm having my retirement match, right? We're keeping this on the down low, but I'm having my retirement match in July. It hasn't been announced yet, but keep your calendar open if you can. I would love for you to be a part of it. So I don't really get that aspect of it. Maybe next week when he speaks out, he'll shed some more light on that. You know, whatever, he's pissed about that as well. As it is, he had his own personal entourage walking him out to the ring. He had his son Gage there. He had Diamond Dallas Page, maybe his greatest opponent of all time. He had Ernest the Cat Miller, Doug Dillinger, who was the head of security for years for WCW. He was the one who used to bang on the door even back then before Goldberg would walk out of the dressing room. Chuck Zito was there. He had plenty of family and friends there with him. He said, I would have loved for them to announce it in January and have a build-up to it and do something that I thought was maybe worthy of my career. But let's just say that they chose to do it with 3 weeks' notice. It is what it is. It's part of the package. It's part of the meal that you get dealt. I would be remiss in thinking that I thought the meal would be different. But it was a shame, it was shame on me for thinking that it would have been different. When asked what specifically could have been different, Goldberg said, well, there's about 100 things. I did 3 interviews beforehand, Ariel. I did 3 in 6 months. They cut me off 30 seconds into my speech, bro. You don't do that, but it's all good. It's clearly not all good. He was choosing his words carefully, but if you watch the video, he was clearly very upset. When he was asked if he felt his speech getting cut off was WWE or the network's call, he said, "I think it doesn't matter because it's live television and you can plan for it. That's all. I know it is what it is and the match might have gone long and this or that, but I just think it could have been a little classier prepared than it was. And I'll just say that's a mild understatement. It is what it is. I got the opportunity to speak for 28 seconds. I'm not saying it was done on purpose by any stretch of the imagination. I'm saying that it wasn't prepared for on purpose. That's all. I mean, they couldn't do that to Taker, right? I don't think they would. They're not going to do that to Cena. No, they're not going to do that to John Cena. And they're not going to do that to The Undertaker because you're not John Cena. And you're not The Undertaker. You're not one of their guys. You never were one of their guys. And you were never as important to them as John Cena and The Undertaker were. So naturally, it would have been a bigger deal for them than it would be for Goldberg. And to compare himself to them in that regard, I think says a lot about his overinflated sense of where he fits in the hierarchy of this company here. Now, he also says that he wishes they had started things back up in January for this. That was never going to happen. Do you know why? Do you know what else started back in January? That would be John Cena's farewell tour. And WWE was never going to give priority to Bill Goldberg's one-off retirement match over a retirement tour for one of their Mount Rushmore names. Every time the man comes out now on TV, they have Michael Cole calling him the greatest of all time. He's the GOAT. He's the GOAT. He's not the greatest of all time, but that's how they view him. That's what they call him. So he's out of his fucking mind if he thinks they were going to run two retirement angles together at the same time. That was never going to happen. The idea that they intentionally sabotaged his speech and that, you know, they formatted the show in such a way that they knew that was going to happen or that it might happen, I just find that to be ridiculous. Part of the problem is that the man still has PTSD from his first run in this company. When Goldberg first came to WWE in 2003, there was heat on all sides. Okay, there were people there that didn't like him. He didn't like them. Triple H being one of those guys. There's a lot of politics going on. That's why when his 1 year was up, he left and didn't renew. He wanted out. It did not go well. And I think that there's still some lingering post-traumatic stress from that first run that he's working through where, you know, they're out to get me. They're trying to bury me and bury my legacy. He sounds paranoid. Yes, if his retirement match happened at SummerSlam or at WrestleMania, there may not have been the same time issues and his speech may not have been cut off. Or maybe it would have been, right? We'll never know. But there was probably less of a chance of that happening. But it's not as if that sort of thing hasn't happened before. Even Sting had his retirement speech cut off. Let us not forget. And that was on pay-per-view. That was not on NBC. I saw Scott D'Amore wrote a piece for Yahoo Sports this week defending Goldberg's criticisms and claiming that Sting's retirement speech got to air in full. No, it didn't. I don't know what he was watching, but I was watching that night. His final words were something to the effect of, "Hold on, they're giving me cues." Like, if you just watched his speech only on the Revolution show and nowhere else, like, that was the those are the final parting words of Sting after his retirement match. Wait a minute, they're giving me cues. Hold on a second. They went over the allotted time, so he got cut off. Those were the last words people heard from Sting. So they put the full thing online after, as WWE did with Goldberg's speech. Fightful said people in the company felt bad that he got cut off, and at least one higher up did apologize to Goldberg personally for what happened. This was not done on purpose. He called it, in the interview with Ariel elsewhere, he called it the ultimate rib. This was no rib, but in his mind, he's the victim. Was it the perfect send-off? No, it wasn't perfect. And I talked about this going into the show, how lazy it was that they set up the match in the way they did, with no thought even put into explaining how this man was waltzing back in and getting a World Heavyweight Championship match, other than, well, it's Goldberg. And then we find out that it's his retirement match, when all you had to do was have Gunther force him into putting his career on the line if you wanted a shot at the title. Therefore, you now have an explanation. they took the laziest path possible for it. Not unlike how they promoted that Evolution show last Sunday. And I always said, Bron Breakker should have been the one to retire Bill Goldberg. Triple H opted not to do that. He wanted Goldberg to wrestle for the title one last time, even though this man did not need to be in a championship match. Maybe that's part of what bothered him. Maybe he would have preferred not to wrestle the champion so that way he could win. He could go out the hero. Did he look at Sting winning his retirement match and say, hey, how come I can't go out like that? Yeah, the funny thing is, maybe he could have. He actually met with Tony Khan 2 years ago. Tony was very complimentary of Bill and the chat they had. Goldberg was not. He shit all over the product and said, oh, it's too cheesy for him. He said he wouldn't be able to look himself in the mirror if he ever joined the AEW roster. And basically, there's no chance. There's no chance that he would ever do that. You know who AEW wasn't too cheesy for? Sting. And Tony Khan gave him the greatest send-off any wrestler has ever gotten. He treated that man like he walked on water. Even when Sting wanted to supposedly lose his final match, Tony said no. He was the one who stepped in and said, no, you're going out as a champion. You're going out undefeated. Maybe Goldberg could have had that, but he slammed that door shut. He's talked before about really wanting his retirement match to take place in Israel. There was even a promoter willing to pay to make it happen, but it never materialized. So WWE was his only real option. I have no idea why he would have buried AEW the way he did and burned that bridge when they would have rolled out the red carpet for him. Maybe even given him a retirement match at Wembley Stadium. I think Wardlow would have been a good opponent for him before he fell off the face of the earth. WWE stepped up to give him what he wanted, but he didn't get everything he wanted. So now he's pissed. He's lucky they gave him a retirement match at all. His first run there sucked. They brought him back 12 years later because he wanted his son to be able to see him wrestle just once. My son has never seen me wrestle. It would be so cool. They allowed that to happen. Not only did they allow it to happen, he pinned Brock Lesnar in 90 seconds. And that went well enough, so they said, hey, why don't you come back again? We'll even put the belt on you. Then he ended Kevin Owens' run as the Universal Champion in 20 seconds. And that's to say nothing of him beating The Fiend for the Universal title. You want to talk victims? There's two right there. And then he had what would have been a great send-off, a WrestleMania 33 against Brock Lesnar, one of the best matches of Goldberg's career. And they were able to erase the stink of their first WrestleMania match. That would have been a great time for him to ride off into the sunset. But they kept paying him to come back, which is when he almost killed The Undertaker. Even last Saturday, Charles Robinson ended up with a cracked rib from that spear that he took. He took one more victim on his way out. When I look back on the last 10 years, I think WWE, on the whole, treated this man very well. And he got to go out in his adopted hometown, in the very city where he won the world title from Hulk Hogan, which, by the way, did not take place on pay-per-view. That match also aired on live TV. This man is not owed anything more than they gave him. He has gotten more out of the wrestling business than he has put into it. And I'm anxious to hear what he has to say next week, or whenever it may be that he decides to speak out about how all of this came together. Maybe certain promises were made to him that weren't kept. Maybe it will cast WWE in a really bad light, and my opinion will slightly shift. But he took what should have been a positive night for him, and in one interview, he turned it into sour grapes, all because he didn't get the storybook ending that he was looking for. And even if he had gotten it, he still would have found something to complain about. Who's next? Who cares? It's time to move on. Some AEW news. The company announced this week that All In will return to Wembley Stadium next year on Sunday, August 30th, 2026, which also happens to be the night after Money in the Bank. That's the make good that WWE gave to the city of New Orleans after giving WrestleMania to them and then taking it away. They're giving them Money in the Bank on August 29th. I was going to give Tony a pat on the back for giving it right back to them, but that's a bank holiday weekend in the UK. which is when he usually runs these shows, so it's more likely the WWE knew that and intentionally scheduled Money in the Bank for that weekend. But now that they've announced All In, I can't wait for the announcement of the first ever two-night Money in the Bank. Fightful is reporting that Will Ospreay is banged up. He will be taking some time away from the ring. The report says that exactly how long he will be gone is not known yet, but there is a belief that he will miss more than a month. And in this week's Wrestling Observer newsletter, Dave Meltzer says that Ospreay's injuries, that's the word he used, which would indicate it's a little more than just being banged up, ended up being worse than he thought. He says there is no time frame for how long Ospreay will be out, and he will be seeing a doctor in the U.S. next week to be fully checked out. He has been a focal point of the advertising for their Forbidden Door show in London next month, so it sounds like there's a good chance he won't be there, at least not in an actual match. I mean, he can make an appearance. I mean, hell, he could do an open challenge if they really wanted to. Ospreay works a very tough style to begin with, but when you factor in all the travel, I mean, this man is an absolute madman. I hear people complain about their commute to work, but this guy lives in the UK and is traveling back and forth to the US almost weekly. Like halfway through the year, he says he's taken 68 flights. He has spent 397 hours in total on airplanes so far this year. At some point, that's got to catch up with you. I spend 5 hours on a plane and I'm ready to jump off. AEW this week also kicked off a 6-show residency at the Aragon Ballroom in Chicago. And on Dynamite, this was the first episode of Dynamite coming out of All In. We had a celebratory opening promo from the new champion, Hangman Adam Page. It is so nice to see the actual championship out and glowing again on TV. And then he was in the main event as well, which was a six-man, right? Six-man tag team match. After the main event, Darby Allin was shown up in the rafters looking down upon Jon Moxley doing his best Sting impression. Outside of a pre-tape promo with MJF reminding Hangman that he's got that world title contract from the Casino Gauntlet to cash in, they did not tease any next challenger for Hangman other than Jon Moxley, which is who it looks like it's going to be. They're going to continue this. Last night on Collision, they even shot an angle where the Death Riders bloodied up Colt Cabana, who was doing guest commentary on the show. Not for very long, he wasn't. They beat him up. They bloodied him. Moxley hung him over the top rope and choked him with a chain until he tapped, just like Hangman did to him at All In. The idea is that Cabana is very good friends with Hangman. Oh, yes, we know. We know. It only led to the most tumultuous period in the history of the company and the loss of its biggest star. I think we know. So with that in mind, they have since announced the match for Dynamite this Wednesday between Hangman and Wheeler Yuta. I mean, you could have knocked me over with a feather when I heard that. I was just paralyzed with excitement. But if Moxley is wrestling Hangman again, then it makes sense that Hangman would go after the Death Riders, especially after what they did to Cabana. I just have no interest in running back the Hangman Death Rider stuff for another pay-per-view. We also got a balcony promo. This is a very interesting venue. I thought it looked great on TV. It looks like a giant theater. I think they had about 1,100 people there, and you have these balconies. And so Toni Storm came out. She looked like fucking Evita. She's standing up there in this balcony, cutting a promo, and she gets interrupted by a video from backstage with Athena and Billy Starks. And Athena reminds her that she won the Women's Casino Gauntlet. She's got that guaranteed contract for an AEW Women's World Championship match, and she's coming for Toni Storm. And there's a match that has been made for Dynamite this Wednesday between Toni Storm and Billy Starks, non-title, obviously. Athena was addressing the crowd on Collision last night and taunting Toni, who ran out and demanded they have their title match right here and now. And Athena declined, but Storm said that if Billy Starks wins their match on Wednesday, she too will earn a women's championship match, which Athena did not care for. I am just happy to see Athena in the mix on AEW television. Finally, after all this time, after the last few years of making, few and far between, we've seen this woman on Dynamite or Collision. Now she's making regular appearances on Collision. She popped up on Dynamite. She's got the guaranteed contract. This is long overdue. So I don't know when they're actually planning on doing the match, if it's going to be a sneaky cash-in because Athena is a heel. I don't know how they're going to do it. I don't know when it's going to happen. I am looking forward to it, though. I'm just happy to see her in the mix. We have Okada, who beat Kenny Omega at All In to become the new Unified Champion. Now they got Don Callis walking around with the International title and the Continental title over his shoulders, like Paul Heyman used to do when Roman had three belts there for a while. So Okada and Swerve is the direction, because Swerve Strickland came out after Okada's match to confront him. I do wonder if the idea was to keep him and Ospreay together for a little bit longer as a tag team, but with Ospreay needing time off, it's like, well, what do we do with Swerve? So, like, was this always the direction for him coming out of All In, or were they going to keep that team going for a while? But Okada and Swerve would be a hell of a match to do, so I think that's great. Adam Copeland was on the show. He addressed Christian and FTR, neither of whom were on the show, but he addressed them in his promo. They are, you know, moving things forward. They're moving the ball down the field when it comes to the eventual Cope and Christian reunion, which we all know is coming. The Young Bucks lost their EVP titles at All In by virtue of their loss to Swerve and Ospreay, and I was hoping we would at least get some funny vignettes on the show showing them coming into the building, and now they're just like everybody else. And they did that. It was only a couple of segments, but they did that. They now appear to be linked up with Don Callis. I mean, everybody is just linking up with Don Callis. This is going to turn into the fucking NWO Black and White before long. So they started some new directions coming out of All In. It just wasn't a show that you felt like you needed to go out of your way to see, especially coming out of their biggest event of the year. You know, they set the table for a few things, but it felt like they were still hungover after the big party. Other news and notes. Former WCW star Buff Bagwell, after a five-year battle of trying to save his right leg, stemming from a car accident in 2020, had his leg amputated above the knee this week. He did everything he felt he could, he says, to try to save the leg, but it was greatly affecting his, not only his mobility, but his quality of life, and he was faced with the choice of either amputation, or, if he wanted to try to save it, three surgeries over the next year, and lots of physical therapy, all for just a 20% chance of saving the leg. And even then, he would have needed a steel rod in the leg for the rest of his life, and he would not have been able to bend it. Which sounds like Brian Pillman's ankle, you know, when it got fused into one place. I mean, that just sounds awful. So he posted a 20-minute video on his own YouTube channel with his fiance Stacy, just explaining the whole situation and how they got there. Maven, who he's become very friendly with in recent years, dropped everything at the last minute to make the 800-mile drive to Bagwell's house to document the entire thing and help him in preparation for the operation. That's a bro right there. Maven also has a video diary on his channel documenting the entire thing. The hospital gave them a hell of a time because they don't allow recording inside the hospital. They say, well, other patients are walking around. We can't have you filming. They said it's a privacy thing. They were hoping to document the actual surgery, but Maven said they ended up being escorted out of the building and having their visitors' passes revoked. But they did get them back. So the surgery was supposed to last 2 hours. There were some complications. It took over 5 hours. But by all accounts, it was successful. And you might have seen the photo floating around of him sitting in his hospital bed, and he's got one leg, and then there's no leg. It's just, you know, where the leg used to be, there's nothing. Bagwell had a serious alcohol addiction for many years, among other issues. He's coming up on 3 years sober next month. But when he had that wreck 5 years ago, he admits that he was driving under the influence. And just the way he talks about it, so matter-of-factly, is crazy that he had been drinking the night before, but he woke up, he downed some Xanax, and then switched to Diet Coke because he knew he was going to be driving. So I won't drink, I'll just down some Xanax here, wash it down with some soda, and we'll be good to go. And he still got behind the wheel. And he was driving his Chevy Tahoe, and he's describing like the whole experience. It was almost like an out-of-body experience, and he can see himself kind of weaving and crashing into cars on the road. And he's driving his Tahoe, and he crashes into a freestanding bathroom at a bus station. He's lucky he didn't kill anybody. know, the fact that it was a few months into the pandemic and there weren't as many people out and about may well have saved a few lives that day. But he broke a bunch of different things, including his ribs and his nose, and he tore his groin. But the leg is what's been giving him issues ever since. And he sounded as optimistic and upbeat as one could be in these videos, given what he was facing. And he says that his quality of life should dramatically improve with a prosthetic. He actually sounded like he was looking forward to just getting this done and over with, which I think tells you what he's been dealing with, that he was ready to do this. And he is still hoping to get back in the ring. He wants to get back in the ring for at least one more match to prove that you can still have a great life after amputation. He said, I want to get back in the ring, hit the ropes, have a match. It'll show that I've come out of the darkness with this thing and I've turned it around all the way to being back in the ring as Buff Bagwell. You don't have to give up with something like this. This is something that I am taking by the horns, and I'm going to show the world that you can have just as good of a life with or without a leg. He's in better spirits than most would be in his position. So best wishes to him for a speedy recovery. Hulk Hogan's Real American Beer has been hit with a $10 million lawsuit involving a licensing company and two former employees. Karma Holdco, Inc. filed the lawsuit in Illinois and alleges that its former president, Chad Bronstein, chief legal and licensing officer, Nicole Crosby, or Cosby, and their company, ROM, Inc., violated state and federal trade secret laws by using proprietary information and intellectual property belonging to Karma when they launched the wrestler-themed beer company. The lawsuit claims that Cosby and Bronstein violated their employment agreements by misappropriating and making use of its proprietary info and its marketing tactics and concepts when developing ROM, Inc. This is according to a story here from Law 360. In other words, Karma is accusing its former executives of swiping its ideas and strategies and poaching Hogan away from them in order to launch their own beer using his name and likeness. Karma claims in the suit that it had entered into a deal with Hogan to be one of its brand ambassadors back in February of 2023. That summer, Bronstein, then an executive at Karma, discussed launching a beer brand using Hogan's likeness. The original idea included using August and Billy Bush of the Bush family. Bronstein, as president and chairman of the board, was intimately involved in and familiar with Karma's plans for Hulk Hogan's Real American brand beer, according to the suit. During this time, Karma was in active discussions with August and Billy Bush, who controlled the trademark for the Real American Lager brand name, to form a joint venture in relation to Hulk Hogan's Real American beer. According to Karma, it hired a designer to create beer can concepts for the Real American brand that includes Hogan's name and image, as well as proposals for an All-American Lager and Patriot Pilsner. Those concepts were provided to Karma in September of 2023. The company is arguing that the proposals, concepts, and business plans for the brand are confidential and proprietary. 2 months later, Karma says it terminated Cosby and Bronstein because the latter had allegedly arranged the deal in a way that would allow him to personally benefit by taking an ownership interest in the beer company. Cosby reportedly provided counsel to Bronstein and authorized the arrangement. After the executives left, Karma said it tried to revitalize negotiations with Hogan and the Bush family for the beer idea, but claims the wrestler became uncooperative and stopped fulfilling his responsibilities as an ambassador per his deal. The complaint accuses Rom, Bronstein, and Cosby of breach of contract, violations of the Defend Trade Secrets Act, the Illinois Trade Secrets Act, tortious interference with contractual relations, and tortious interference with prospective business relations. The company is seeking $348,000 in restitution for the breach of contract from Bronstein and another $231,000 from Cosby. Karma is also seeking damages, restitution, royalties, and a court order to stop Bronstein and Cosby from using its trade secrets and to stop them from selling products they believe use stolen trade secrets. I don't know what the likelihood is here of success, but that sounds to me like if they are successful, that could very well be the end of Real American Beer. So we shall see where things go with that. Meanwhile, Hogan still has not been seen or heard from in over 2 months. He was admitted to the hospital on May 14th for spinal fusion surgery. And as far as anybody knows, he's been there for over 60 days. Now, maybe he's in a different hospital than the one he was admitted to, but he has not come out since. Most people spend less than 3 days in the hospital after a surgery like that. It was maybe a month after the operation when Bubba the Love Sponge, I talked about him on the show, he started sharing information on his radio show. He and Hogan used to be very tight. Obviously, they've had a falling out, so they're not close anymore, but they do share a lot of friends. They share a lot of acquaintances. And about a month ago, Bubba started sharing information on his show that Hogan was in the hospital and was on his deathbed with some sort of heart issue. And that led to Eric Bischoff issuing a statement saying that Hogan had a successful cervical surgery and was having an adverse reaction, but he's doing well and should be home later that day. Doctors are expecting a full recovery. A month later, Hogan is still not home. Hogan's wife, Skye, posted to her Instagram stories this past week to share her response to a fan asking if Hogan was in a coma. She wrote, "No, he's definitely not in a coma. His heart is strong, and there was never any lack of oxygen or brain damage. None of those rumors are true. He's been recovering from a major 4-level anterior cervical discectomy and fusion, ACDF, which is an intense surgery with a long and layered healing process. If you look it up, you'll see what the last 6 weeks have involved, not just for his spine, but also for his vocal cords." Yeah, because I think they have to like move the vocal cords aside, I think, when they go in for it. "But also for his vocal cords and the eating / breathing tubes that are clamped over during surgery. We've been in and out of the hospital to support that recovery, so truly there is no need for the drama or panic that some people try to stir up. He's healing, and we are taking it one day at a time with love, strength, and patience." Whatever's really going on, it's clearly very serious. Because if it wasn't, they would have had him post something by now. So he must be in rough shape. I guess, look, the man has an image to uphold and doesn't want people seeing him this way. Or maybe the people around him don't want people seeing him this way. But his Real American Freestyle League is still set to hold its first event later next month, and they announced this week that Kurt Angle has signed on to be a live event commentator and analyst for the league. Last month, they had only 380 tickets sold for that first show. The latest total from WrestleTix has them up to 639 tickets in a building that fits up to 15,000. You know, the entire reason they even anointed Hogan as their commissioner, because he's the commissioner of the league. I don't know that carries any actual commissioner duties, but he's sort of the face of it. The only reason they did that was for the publicity that he would bring. They weren't counting on him being so quiet that people think he's lying comatose in a hospital bed somewhere. Let's take some mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolomonster at gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Calvin from Anaheim. "Why does it feel as if Triple H doesn't have a great plan mapped out for John Cena's farewell tour? It just feels as if they are coasting with this retirement tour and they did not map out what they had planned for one of their biggest stars. I know Rock may have ruined his plans when he wanted Cody to turn heel and then having Cena go heel rather than having their top babyface go heel too soon. Cena's heel run has been fairly disappointing, and it feels like they could have done more with it." Of course they could have done more with it. I mean, it's not like the worst thing in the world, but for what should have been this monumental thing in this guy's final year, it turned out to be largely a dud. So could they have done better with it? Sure. Does it feel like they didn't have it fully mapped out or thought out? Yes, because they didn't. So you're 100% right. Graham from WrestleRant. What's going on, Graham? "Adam Page is considered to be the main character of AEW, and rightfully so, given the outstanding character arc he's had since the start of the company. With that said, who would you consider to be the main character of WWE in the last 5 to 10 years? Seth Rollins would be my pick, since his character arc has been the most consistent of anyone's in the company, and his face heel turns have always felt organic. Roman Reigns is another choice, given the entire company revolved around him as champion. But his stories and character work prior to that were all over the place. Cody Rhodes is an honorable mention with the whole finish the story thing because it made him the focal point of WWE since he came back." Yeah, and I mean, if you said over the last 10 years, like 5 to 10 years, Cody's been back for 3. So Cody is not the answer. Seth Rollins is a fine choice, but it's Roman Reigns, as far as I'm concerned. you're not wrong when you say that there's been a lot of inconsistencies with Roman, or frankly, a lot of the stuff they were doing with him 10 years ago was just fucking awful. But how is the main character of WWE over the last decade anybody other than Roman Reigns? Everything's been built around him, even when it wasn't working, and then when it was. But whether it was working or not, he was certainly positioned as the main character. Everything sort of flowed through him, and then the tribal chief thing happened, and that took him to a whole different level. But the main character of this company, when I think back over the last 10 years, going back to 2015, is absolutely Roman Reigns. Max from New Jersey, after everything played out, do you think Cody should have beaten Roman at WrestleMania 39, or was the extra year worth the wait for the Mania 40 match? I would argue I still think Cody should have won the title at 39. Think about the limbo the main event scene was in during 2023 after he won. Roman was gone a lot, and the World Heavyweight title had the stigma of being the consolation belt. Had Cody won at 39, Roman could have had his limited schedule without holding two titles hostage, and Cody could have either split up the titles, so the Universal title goes to Raw, or Cody could have fully unified the two belts, and we still get the World Heavyweight title without the negative stigma. You could also have still done the tag team match at 40, but with Cody as champion, Roman pins Cody on night one, giving him his win back. But then on night two, Cody pins Roman in Bloodline rules. Look, everything worked out well with WrestleMania 40. I still feel the way I felt before. I do think he should have won at 39. You could have done more or less the same story. I mean, it wouldn't have been exactly the same story, but you could have done something similar if you wanted Rock involved and then gone off with Rock and Roman. I mean, there's any number of ways you could have gone with it, but... No, I mean, I still feel like he should have won at 39, but I am happy with how things ended at 40. So, I mean, make of that what you will. Brianna from Jackson, Mississippi, coming off the heels of AEW's best women's match to date and the best PLE all year in Evolution, who do you rank as the top 10 women in wrestling currently? This list does not have to be ranked in order. Well, that's good because I'm not ranking them. But these would be my 10 so far this year. I'm including Liv Morgan because she was one of the top female performers in any promotion until she got hurt. And performers, by the way, doesn't just mean in-ring performers. She was doing, you know, great in the ring and had some great in-ring performances this year, but a lot of it had to do with her character work as well. So Liv Morgan is on there for sure. The rest of my list, the other nine, look like this. Rhea Ripley, Io Sky, Toni Storm, Mercedes Moné, Athena, Stephanie Vaquer, Becky Lynch, Lyra Valkyria, and Willow Nightingale. That's my top 10. Now, that isn't inclusive of any of the great Joshi wrestlers from, you know, the Japanese promotions. I just haven't seen enough of them this year to include them in my list. And I'll give honorable mentions to Masha Slamovic, who I know has been holding it down as the TNA Knockouts champion this year. Again, I just haven't seen enough of those matches to judge. But those are my 10 midway through the year. Jack from England. Is it true Yokozuna was at one point considered for a run in WCW so that Hulk Hogan could get his win back? The part about Hogan wanting to get his win back was never confirmed anywhere, but yes, that was the belief. They were interested in bringing him in sometime either in 97 or 98. I think 98. WWE still had him under contract through 98. I think maybe it was through May of that year. People didn't know that, but he was still under contract. So he would not have been able to go anyway unless it was later in the year or WWE let him out of his deal. But there was a reason that he was off WWE television. He had gained so much weight. No state athletic commission in their right mind would allow that man to wrestle. He was a walking heart attack waiting to happen. He was so morbidly obese. Like, go watch the main event of that Heroes of Wrestling pay-per-view in 99. Actually, better yet, don't do that. But if you see him there, you'll know why he had no business being in the ring. He had to be at that point. And I know they've claimed that at his peak, legitimately, he was up to 804 pounds. And I do believe that to be legit. I don't remember exactly when that would have been. I don't think he was 800 at the very end. But like, you see him in that video of Heroes of Wrestling, like, he's every bit of 700 pounds plus by that point. And then a year later, he was dead. It just wasn't a situation where any company was going to be able to use him. Ariel from Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic. I'm Ariel Richardson, not Santana, as the other fan thought. Well, there you go. I think he got confused, but Ariel Santana is a wrestling fan as well. I was thinking about some wrestlers always being tied to a manager. Brock Lesnar with Paul Heyman, Undertaker and Paul Bearer, Bobby Heenan and Andre the Giant. But when did this idea of a wrestling manager start? I don't know who it started with exactly, but I know it goes back at least to the 50s. Actually, earlier than that, I think, oh God, who was it? Jim Londos. Jim Londos had a manager. Londos is in the WWE Hall of Fame, and he had a manager. And he was one of the most popular stars from the 30s and 40s. So it goes back at least that far. But Gorgeous George's wife was managing him. Not just his actual affairs, but I believe she was managing him on his way to the ring and, you know, was visible with him. He may have had another manager after her, another woman. So, I mean, the wrestling manager was hardly some new concept in the 70s and 80s when that's when it really started to become popular. It goes back to at least the 40s and 50s. And maybe even a little bit earlier than that. But I can't tell you who the first person was to come out with a manager. I don't know who that is. David from the UK. So I read the other day that it has now been known as WWE longer than it was the WWF. This blew my mind, and it started a conversation with my old wrestling friends. I brought up the fact that I remember it being called WWFE briefly, which no one could remember. Am I going crazy? Were there any episodes of Raw or SmackDown which referred to the company as WWFE? I just don't know where I would have gotten that random memory from. I wasn't really using wrestling forums or anything at that time. Please set my head straight. I'll set you straight right now. You're not crazy. WWFE was a real thing, but it was never anything they referred to themselves as on TV. So unless you were a stockbroker, I have no idea where you would have seen it. But when Vince took the company public in 99 and they launched their IPO, the stock traded on the NASDAQ under the WWFE symbol until they changed their name to WWE. That was in 2002. So it wasn't WWFE for very long, but it stood for World Wrestling Federation Entertainment, which replaced Titan Sports. When they went public, Titan Sports went away. It was basically a holding company that Vince created when he bought it from his dad. So Titan Sports went away. WWFE is how they were recognized corporately. And then they became WWE. So I have no idea where you would have seen that from, but you're not crazy. Conrad from Buffalo, New York. Day one listener of the podcast with a buy, sell, rent 1995 edition. Bret Hart against Diesel at Survivor Series. Bret Hart against the British Bulldog at In Your House Season's Beatings. Shawn Michaels against Razor Ramon, ladder match at SummerSlam. All great matches. All favorites of mine. I've got a buy on the ladder match between Shawn and Razor. I actually think it's not as important as the ladder match, the first one they had at WrestleMania. It's not as well-remembered. It's not talked about as often. It doesn't make the highlight reels in the way that that first one does. But I think objectively, it's a better ladder match than the first one. I'm buying on that one. I'm renting on Bret Hart and Diesel at the Survivor Series in 95. That was the best of all the matches they ever had. And I'm going to sell on Bret and the Bulldog from In Your House, which was a great match, but I just can't rank it above the other two. And Jerry from Philadelphia. What is something that you have a greater respect for in the pro wrestling industry since you joined House of Glory? That's a great question. I mean, I have always had great respect for what wrestlers do and putting their bodies on the line. I guess just being able to see it more up close gave me a greater appreciation for what goes into what they do before they step out through the curtain. But I will also tell you that beyond talent and match preparation, production. It's a team effort that goes into making it all work, even when it doesn't. And believe me, there are many times where it doesn't. But it's this great team effort that a lot of people will never know about. It doesn't get talked about. You don't see it, you know, when the show streams, you don't see it. You see it, you hear it, you hope that the quality is up to standard, but there's a lot that goes into making that happen. And I have a greater appreciation for that as well in a way that I didn't before. So I hope that that answers your question. And I hope that answers all of your questions. I'll try to get to more of them next week. That'll be on episode 922. But for now, I must bid you adieu. We have come to the end of our journey here. Please follow me on X at Solomonster is where I am still the most active. And subscribe on YouTube, Solomonster Sounds Off. I'll be live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday this week, but I will also be live tonight for the TNA Slammiversary recap. As soon as the pay-per-view goes off the air from the UBS Arena, I will not be at UBS, but I will be here to talk about the show. And of course, I'll be with JD on his channel Tuesday night. That'll be episode 104, I do believe, of Tuesday Night Titans. So you got a lot of content coming your way this week and back here next Sunday for episode 922. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week wherever you may be. And I will see you tonight on YouTube for the Slammiversary review. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
The AEW Women's World Champion. It was Timeless Tony Storm up in the balcony overlooking the rest of the theater. Tony says, "Enough of this gay banter. This whore you all adore. This slut you can't rebut. This bitch you want to itch," she says. "This skank you want to spank. This trollop you can't wallop. This tramp is still the champ."
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good,
the bad,
and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Solomonster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Solomonster.
I love you so long.